There's some economic optimism about 2010.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the Morning Open, a look at the broader economy as trading gets underway for the day. So we ask, where's Wall Street? Markets were mixed in Asia today, but it seems here at home, things are looking up. The S&P 500 up about 1.5%, NASDAQ up more than 1.5% this morning, and the Dow right now up more than 146 points at 10,464. In Europe, shares in London, Frankfurt, and Paris are up as well, about 1% or more. Oil's trading at just above $78 a barrel in Asia because of some uncertainty with Iran and its neighbors. A new survey out today shows business economists are seeing some rays of light through the clouds of unemployment, that companies will start to hire again, and the hiring will take place starting next year. Marketplace's John Dimsdale is with us live this morning from our Washington Bureau. Good morning, John.
Hello, Steve.
And Bill Stone is Chief Investment Strategist at PNC Wealth Management. He's with us live in Philadelphia. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
All right, John, I want to start with you, this business economist report. Why the positive news?
Well, they're seeing stirrings in demand for the products and services that the companies that employ these economists make. And since their companies have cut expenses and jobs already to the bone, they're going to have to start hiring to meet that demand. The NABE's Richard DeKayser says rehiring is going to show up early next year, but he does expect it to be slow.
With gains in labor productivity, businesses are increasingly able to satisfy increases in demand up to a certain point. But beyond that point, they will have to hire new labor, and we think we're approaching that switching point right about now.
All right, that was Richard DeKayser. Bill Stone, haven't we heard this all before? Hasn't the stock market also been predicting economic recovery?
I think it has. I think when you think back on the fact that the market started heading higher in March, long before there were any, I'd say real signs of recovery. I think it is. The market's been signaling that that the sustainable recovery was coming, and at least I guess it better if you want to stocks to hold in here.
Hey, John, jobs on the rebound would be good political news for the Democrats, who have control of pretty much of everything in Washington, right?
That's right. They're going to argue that all of this is thanks to the $800 billion stimulus package. Now, Republicans are going to question whether that was really worth the money, and they're going to be backed up by a sobering report in the New York Times this morning about how the government's been able to afford these record deficits, and it's because of low interest rates. And those rates are bound to go up in a recovery, and it's going to put the government in the same dilemma that homebuyers found themselves in with teaser mortgage rates that eventually come to an end that triggers much higher monthly payments.
Mm, we've heard that before, haven't we? And this is going to cost the government a lot more to finance the debt down the road, right?
The Times says around $200 billion a year now could be $700 billion by the end of the decade.
Well, all right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale with us at our Washington Bureau. Thanks to you, John.
Thanks, Steve.
Bill Stone still on the line with us. Bill, we just heard from John about the job market perhaps bottoming out next year. What about real estate and the market there? We get existing home sales here in just a few minutes, right? I mean, when is this home market gonna bounce back?
Well, I think you're seeing signs that that it's at least stabilized, and I think you're going to see more signs of it today with those existing home sales. We think they might actually be down a little bit from last month, though the consensus is that they'll be up a little bit. But we think there's some of this, it's kind of like the cash for clunkers since the new home buyer, there was a little worries about that expiring, et cetera. We think it'll snap back around again. One way or another, it's kind of holding above that $5 million unit level that really kind of marks the what we hope is the bottom of things.
Yeah, 5 million. You could buy a house in L.A. for that, couldn't you? All right, Bill Stone joining us this morning from Philadelphia. Bill, thanks.
Thanks.
Listening to the Marketplace Morning Report for Monday, November 23rd, 2009, at marketplace.org. We use Google for a lot of things, but one of them is to search for news stories. But what if a newspaper pulled its content from Google? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins takes a look at what that might mean for the world's most used search engine and its rival.
News Corp wants to get paid for its newspaper stories available online. Its owner, Rupert Murdoch, has been vocal about how he thinks news companies need to charge for web content. Now he has a plan. The Financial Times reports his company is in discussions to take its content off Google and move it to Microsoft search engine Bing. The talks are in the early stages, but the idea is that Microsoft might pay to feature News Corp's papers. Caroline Wiertz of the Cass Business School in London says this could drive other media companies to do the same thing.
If we then come into a world where you can't basically Google all content anymore and get it for free, then I think consumers would be incentivized. And News Corp is large enough to make that first move, and I think they realize that.
For now, it seems this is just about newspaper articles. But it could help Microsoft chip away at Google's dominance, being accounted for less than 10% of online searches last month. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
We heard John Dimsdale talking about the job market. On the other side of the pond, the head of the International Monetary Fund says the global recovery is still too weak and that governments shouldn't abandon their stimulus packages yet. More from London correspondent Stephen Beard.
IMF Chief Dominic Strauss-Kahn told business leaders in London today that the global economy is improving, but he said it's still too early for governments to turn off the spigot just yet, and he said central banks should keep their interest rates low for some time to come. Better to err on the side of caution, he said. The IMF boss warned there are still many problems besetting the global economy, like high unemployment and large budget deficits. Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank says Strauss-Kahn is right to be gloomy.
There may still be another leg of the housing crisis to come. The prime mortgage business in the US doesn't look too great. There's still more in the housing sector in Europe to come. There are many things still to be resolved and things that could go seriously wrong.
This morning, Strauss-Kahn said that with little sign of inflation on the horizon, governments and central banks can afford to pump even more money into the global economy. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Anti-hunger charity Bread for the World puts out its 2010 hunger report later today. The recession has worsened hunger all around the world, but the organization says there are plenty of policy changes that could help solve the problem. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Almost one in four American kids lives in a household that's struggling to put food on the table. David Beckman of Bread for the World wants the government to strengthen child nutrition programs and expand tax credits for the working poor so no child goes hungry.
This is not rocket science. We know how to make sandwiches. And we can feed kids in America, even in the middle of this recession.
He says pumping money into the U.S. economy isn't enough to help everybody.
Just expanding the national economy without paying much attention to what you're expanding is going to lead to a very short-term recovery. What we need to do is use this time of economic crisis to invest in a more just and sustainable society.
He says attacking climate change is another way to help. Green jobs could decrease unemployment. And he says cutting down on fossil fuels would help curb the change in climate that's already affecting people's livelihoods in developing countries, including food production. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
If you look at a map of the New York City subway system, there's one big part of Manhattan that's not covered. It's the far east side, from 125th Street all the way downtown to the East Village. There have been plans in the works to build a new subway line along 2nd Avenue since the 1920s. But every time it's about to get built, the economy turns down and the plans get shoved aside. Until now, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from the Big Apple.
That's the sound of subway construction deep below the high-rises on Manhattan's far Upper East Side. Despite tight budgets, it's actually happening. The biggest expansion of the New York City subway since the 1940s. The Metropolitan Transit Authority's Jeremy Soffin says it'll be worth the $4.4 billion price tag, and that's just for the first few stations.
If you put something aside every time there's a fiscal crisis, then it's an entire generation before you can pick it up again.
And he says New York needs this subway. Right now, the only line serving the entire east side of Manhattan is the Lexington Avenue line.
We have approximately 1.7 million trips taken on the line on an average day, which, to give you some perspective, is more than the number of trips on the Washington and Chicago systems combined, the entire systems.
Other cities hoping to expand their transit systems are having a tougher time getting funding in this economy. Robert Puentes is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program.
The unfortunate reality is that we're facing not just cuts in service in many of these places, but they're also having to cut back on some of the expansion plans.
New York was lucky. Most of the funding for Phase 1 of the Second Avenue line came before the Great Recession. Though even as construction's gotten underway, the finish line continues to slip back. Benjamin Kaback follows every toss and turn on his blog, SecondAvenueSagas.com.
Do you think that you will ever be able to blog about the day when one of the stations finally opens?
I think I will. I think we'll see some stations open in 5 or 6 years or 7 years. Whether or not we'll ever be able to ride the Second Avenue subway from Hanover Square all the way up to 125th Street, I wouldn't put too much money on that.
But voters from New York to Phoenix do seem willing to put money into public transit expansion. Again, Robert Puentes.
These are the kind of bold investments that this nation used to make a few decades ago. I do sense that there is some desire to move back to those kinds of investments.
He says the important thing for elected officials is to make sure taxpayers can see results. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
This morning, we're going to get the latest on the federal investigation into problems caused by Chinese drywall. The report could have big implications for homeowners, as Joel Rose reports.
The drywall under investigation was used to build an estimated 60 to 100,000 homes, mostly in Florida, Louisiana, and Virginia. It's been blamed for nosebleeds and breathing problems, among other things. Scott Wolfson is a spokesman for the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, which is releasing the results of its latest investigation today.
This is part of our commitment to families affected by this drywall issue to put scientific data out there as soon as it becomes available.
Last month, the commission said the drywall contains unusually high levels of several chemicals, including sulfur, but stopped short of saying there was a link between those chemicals and any health problems. That outraged Allison Grant, a Florida attorney who represents hundreds of clients with Chinese drywall in their homes.
Most of the clients I spoke to, I mean, my phone was ringing off the hook. They felt like they'd been slapped in the face.
Grant says today's report could determine whether homeowners with Chinese drywall can claim a significant write-off on their income taxes. The first lawsuit is scheduled to go to trial in January. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Also in China, a deadly coal mine blast in the north killed at least 104 miners over the weekend. Authorities blame improper management at the mine. The sad reality is mine deaths in China are pretty common. Marketplace Asia Bureau Chief Scott Tong has seen one of these Chinese mines in that part of the country, and he joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Steve.
So how did this explosion happen?
Well, the mine says it was a buildup of the deadly gas methane. In many Chinese mines, they're supposed to have these methane gauges, and when the level gets too high, they cut all the power in the mine, and that's the miner's signal to get out. Well, in this case, a mine spokesman says they started to evacuate the night shift at about 1:30 in the morning. The blast came about an hour later, and it turns out about one-fifth of the men apparently did not make it out, Steve.
This is a big tragedy, Scott, but it's pretty common, right, in China?
It's got to be one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. We all remember the Somerset, Pennsylvania mine disaster in the States back in 2002. We were all watching, and thank goodness they rescued all nine of the men. Well, nine men, that's one day in China. I mean, that's the average single-day casualty toll for Chinese miners.
Wow.
And for the risk they take, they earn a relative fortune in one of the poorest parts of China. They make about $15 a day. And these are the most valuable jobs in town. I mean, the families I talked to said they do whatever they can to get their husbands and sons these jobs, get the right connections, bribe the right people, whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes to get one of those jobs. What's the latest from those family members, Scott?
Well, a lot of the spouses came this morning, and they reportedly scuffled with local police and mine officials for not giving these spouses enough information. Some of them, it turns out, were carted off. The state media says families will be compensated about $40,000 per casualty.
All right. Marketplace's Asia Bureau Chief Scott Tong joining us from Shanghai. Scott, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
And finally, there's salvation for a Long Island, New York golf club that had been in the bunker. Many of North Shore Country Club's members were burned by Bernie Madoff in his infamous Ponzi scheme. Membership at the club dropped by 40%. They had to lay off 26 employees. Then came real estate developer Don Zucker to the rescue. Zucker put up $12.5 million for the club, told the New York Post he's tickled by the purchase and just wants access to a golf course. Don't we all, Mr. Zucker? Don't we all? I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. This is Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.